In other words, they are non-trivial saddle points of a quantum mechanical path or functional integral. And as we've seen in the front end, if we're going to do a saddle prime approximation, like we did in QFT2 to study the functional integral, we should sum over all of the relevant saddle points. And some of those saddle points are non-trivial.
Wait, but Dan, can't you always add a constant to the action and then make it non-zero?
Yes, so here, this basically means non-trivial field configuration. So when I say non-zero, I'm implicitly setting the action of the field configuration where all the fields are zero to zero. I could add a constant to change that. It wouldn't affect the physics, but that's going to be implicit in basically everything we do.
I'm sorry, could you explain what is non-trivial configuration, please?
So what I call a trivial configuration is if all of the fields are zero and we expand around that configuration. That's basically what we've been doing in the previous QFT courses. So we assumed that all of the fields were zero and that the we just considered fluctuations around the zero field configuration.
When we think of classical solutions, we have non-zero classical solutions.
That's right. That's what we're going to see.
I don't see why they are considered to be zero. See what I mean?
Well, for instance, we looked at 5-4 theory in several different contexts. The field configuration that minimizes the energy and the trivial field configuration is the field configuration where phi is zero everywhere. And when we were doing perturbation theory, we were basically perturbing about that configuration.
But when we solve the Klein-Gordon blah, 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 we find plane wave, but they are on zero.
That's right. And those, we were treating those as perturbations. Perhaps this point will become more clear when we look at some examples.
Is it related to having one-point functions being zero?
That's right, yes. Yeah. That's related. So. Okay. So instantons are non-trivial saddle points. Of the functional integral. And contributions from instantons are typically exponentially small. So they might go like e to the minus a over g, where g is some small coupling, and a is a constant. And so exponentially small functions like this are completely invisible in perturbation theory. That's why we haven't discussed them so far, because so far we've been doing perturbation theory. So what I mean by when I say this function is invisible in perturbation theory is if we try to compute the Taylor series of this function about g equals zero, all the terms are zero. This is a non-zero function. Nevertheless, its Taylor series is all the terms in Taylor series are zero. And so we'll never see the effects of instantons if we're doing perturbation theory. So these are the effects we're going to be considering are known as non-perturbative effects. And so sometimes it turns out that there are no perturbative contributions. So these effects are typically very small. But if there are no perturbative contributions, then instantons can provide the dominant or leading contribution to some a factor or quantity of interest. And so there are two examples that you may be familiar with from quantum mechanics. Where exponentially small effects are the leading contributions. And these two examples are in one-dimensional quantum mechanics. If we have a symmetric double well potential, like this, then, well, naively, this has a degenerate ground state, but there's an energy splitting between the first excited state and the ground state, which is unique, the energy of those two states, which is exponentially small in, say, the G here could be the coefficient of the quartic term. Even if this is not just a quartic potential, just some general symmetric double well potential, the difference between the energies of the two lowest states will be exponentially small. So it'll be invisible in perturbation theory. And we can compute this energy splitting using instantons. Another example, again from one-dimensional quantum mechanics, so if we have an unstable potential, then the decay rate will generally be exponentially small and invisible in perturbation theory. The perturbation theory about this false vacuum state, we're not going to know what's going on for the potential for large x, and won't be able to compute the decay rate. So you may have examined these two problems in your undergraduate quantum mechanics course. If you did, you probably used the WKB approximation, which involves solving the Schrodinger equation in classically allowed and classically forbidden regions and matching them to the solutions together in the different regions. Sometimes WKB approximation, or its generalizations, can work in quantum field theory. But it's generally very hard, and for most problems, very, very hard, even if it can be used. And for many problems, it's just practically impossible to use the WKB approximation. That involves finding the wave function. And so in quantum field theory, you'd be finding a wave functional, which is an infinite dimensional, which makes things difficult. So we're going to examine these problems, if you've seen them before, in a different way, using instantons, which may be a little bit more difficult for solving these problems, but has the huge advantage that it generalizes easily to quantum field theory, which will be our main interest. And so this new technique using instantons will work almost in the same way in quantum field theory as in quantum mechanics, with some differences that we'll discuss. So the other case, so these are two cases where instantons provide the leading contribution. Sometimes we're interested in a quantity that has perturbative contributions, but there may also be instanton contributions on top of that. So suppose we're interested in computing some quantity. This is an exact quantity that we're trying to compute. It depends on some small coupling. This could be an energy, it could be an amplitude, could be an expectation value of some operator, just some quantity we want to compute. We've seen in the front end and QFT1 and 2 that in general, if we do perturbation theory, what we get is a series in our coupling, but it's generally not a convergent series. It's usually an asymptotic series and it's usually a divergent series. So, well, that's perturbation theory. There'll also be, in general, instanton contributions, which are exponentially small. So another question we'll address is, in what sense does this equation make sense? We have something exact that we expect to be finite for small g. This is divergent. This is really small. How can we add something divergent to something really small to get something finite? And I'll have a few more to say about that tomorrow. So these are the kinds of questions we're going to address, first in quantum mechanics and then in quantum field theory. So where we're going over the next three lectures is first today we'll look at instantons in quantum mechanics. We'll look at these problems and attack them using a new method, not the WKB approximation. Then tomorrow, we will first examine the analog of this problem in quantum field theory, in scalar quantum field theory. So here we've got an unstable potential in quantum field theory. We could have a scalar field that has multiple minima. And if we start out in a higher energy minimum, tunneling can take us to the true vacuum of the theory by a bubble nucleation. We'll examine, so in the first part of tomorrow's lecture, we'll examine that process. And then in the second part of lecture, I'll have a few more things to say about this case where we've got both perturbative and non-perturbative contributions and how to make sense of this schematic equation. And then in the final lecture, we will discuss an analog of this problem in gauge theories. So gauge theories have degenerate vacua, or approximately degenerate vacua, and the degeneracy is lifted by instanton effects. So we'll examine how that works in gauge theory on Friday, and these approximately degenerate vacua are known as the theta vacua. Theta is some parameter that parameterizes the different approximately degenerate vacua. So that's where we're going for the course overall. And any questions on where we're going? Okay. So more specifically, for today, as I mentioned before, we're going to stick to quantum mechanics. And first, I'll briefly discuss how to get the ground state energy from a Euclidean path integral. So the questions we'll be asking today are things like differences between the two energy lowest energy states and decay rates, which can be related to energies of resonant states. And we'll spend the bulk of the rest of the lecture examining this problem. This problem will we examine this problem in some detail, we'll see most of the ingredients we need to examine other problems like this one, and also the periodic potential. And so in the last part of lecture, time permitting, maybe this will get pushed off till tomorrow, I'll briefly discuss what will change if we consider different potentials in quantum mechanics, namely the periodic potential and the unstable potential. So these two problems we'll borrow significantly from our work in studying the double well potential. So for today, the quantities we're going to be interested in computing are going to be energies, so either energy differences or decay rates, which we can think of as the imaginary part of the energy. And the technique we're going to use is the saddle point approximation applied to Euclidean path integrals in quantum mechanics. So before we go about computing the path integrals using the saddle point approximation, just want to briefly discuss how to get energies, particularly the ground state energy, from the Euclidean path integral. Okay, so path integral we'll consider is the propagator that we discussed in QFT, the beginning of QFT2. So written as its amplitude, and the path integral expression for this is just the integral over all paths x of t of e to the minus Euclidean action over h bar with boundary conditions x at minus t over 2 is equal to xi, and x at t over 2 is equal to xf. Okay. This will be our main object of study. We'll use the saddle point approximation to study it. And well, if we computed this object, we can read off the ground state energy. And to see that, let's denote our energy eigenstates by n, and our energy eigenvalues by en, with e0 being the smallest energy eigenvalue. Then if we insert a complete set of states into this expression, what we get is that this expression here, we've just inserted a complete set of states, which are energy eigenstates. So we can just pull out this factor of e to the minus ht over h bar, and we get this expression. And if we want to read off the ground state energy, we can just note that as t, E0 is the smallest energy eigenvalue. So as t goes to infinity, it decays the most slowly. So the ground state energy we can read off in this expression just by taking the limit as t goes to infinity of h bar over t times the log of z. That gives us the ground state energy. And so the end of lecture, we'll discuss this case. This potential has no ground state. It does have resonant states, which we can define by considering a scattering problem here with boundary conditions that the incoming wave function vanishes. And those resonant states will be quantized as well, and they'll be complex. And so for the unstable potential, even though there is no ground state, basically the same thing works. And we can get the decay rate, which will be the other quantity we're interested in, from the imaginary part. I'll use the same notation. Now the interpretation is slightly different in the unstable case. Okay, and so the basic strategy we're going to use today is we're going to use the saddle point approximation to approximate this integral. And so that integral has saddles. So the saddle points x bar satisfy the equation that the variation of the action with respect to x bar of t are 0. So that's just the, now we've got path integrals, but this is basically the same equation we looked at when we studied finite dimensional integrals using the saddle point approximation. And throughout today's lecture, we'll just be assuming that we have a particle in one dimension with unit mass and some potential. So in that case, this equation will just read and what today we'll assume that S E is the integral of 1/2 x dot squared plus V. Okay. And so at leading order in saddle point approximation, we just need to find all the saddle points and sum over them. If we wanted to go to next order, we should expand Euclidean action in the path integral about the saddle points and include fluctuations. And we could keep going. The linear term vanishes by this equation. And here I'm using the notation that x tilde is just the fluctuation of the path away from the saddle point path. And this notation is the same as times, as in QFT2. This is the integral dt1 dt2 tilde of t1. And the second functional derivative of s back to x of t1, x of t2. And so if we use the saddle point approximation for this path integral, what we'll get is some normalization. We need to sum over the saddles. And at leading order, we just get e to the minus se of x bar over h bar, where x bar are our saddles. If we go to next to leading order, doing the path integral of this term, this is just a Gaussian integral in x tilde. And so if we do that integral, we'll just get a determinant. And so next to leading order, we get just this determinant of s double prime of x bar to the minus a half. So this is your normalization. And this is from the Gaussian integration. H bar.
Or is it just a normalization?
Just a normalization. Okay, so this is basically the same procedure we did in QFT2. Main difference now is that between what we're going to do today and what we did in QFT2 is that we're going to be and have to sum over a bunch of non-trivial saddles. And of course, if we wanted to go to higher order, there would be corrections for this formula. We're never going to consider higher order corrections in these lectures, and we won't even always go to this order. I'll say a few words about this second order term, but we're mostly going to discuss this sum over the saddle. Okay, that's what we're going to try to do, and first problem we'll apply this technique to is the symmetric double well potential. So we want to study this potential. That has degenerate minima at A and minus A. We'll assume this is symmetric. Goes to minus x, and we'll also assume that near both of the minima, the potential looks like a quadratic function. Those are our assumptions. We won't specify an explicit form for v. We won't need it for most of what we're going to do. And the question we're going to ask is, what is the energy splitting between the ground state and the first excited state? Which the ground state and the first excited state will turn out to be symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations of the states that just sit at A or minus A. Okay. So the first thing we're going to do, and we're going to compute this energy splitting by computing four different path integrals, which are related by symmetry. So we'll actually only have to compute two of them. We'll compute the propagators from plus or minus A to plus or minus A, with all possible choices of sign. So these states are not energy eigenstates, but linear combinations of them will be. And so if we compute these four path integrals, but two of them, they're related by symmetry in pairs, we can get the energy eigenvalues just by diagonalizing. So first thing we want to compute is, let's choose the positive sign for our final state and the negative sign for our initial state. And we want to compute this amplitude by using the saddle point approximation on the path integral. And so our saddle point equation is this. So here, v prime indicates a derivative of v with respect to x. And this equation should look familiar. It's almost the equation you get if you were had a particle of unit mass and a potential v. The difference is this potential is on the wrong side of the equation. So this is just the equation of motion for a particle of unit mass in a potential minus v.
And are you missing a minus sign?
Am I?
It looks like this is the right equation.
Yeah, there was a minus sign.
Yes, I am missing a minus sign. And okay, so that means we want to do is solve this equation, which basically means we want to find trajectories for a particle that starts at minus A and ends up at A. So we've got a particle in a potential. And one way to solve that is by solving the equation of motion. As you know from classical mechanics, an easier way to solve that is by using energy conservation. And so in this case, the energy is just this. Constant of motion. And we can find solutions, saddle points, by solving this equation, the first order, which is easier than solving that equation. Second order. And just by looking at our potential, we see that there exists a zero energy solution. So we could have a particle that's sitting here and just rolls over here. It's got enough energy to go from here to here, even if the energy is zero. And, well, without knowing precisely what v is, we can't find an explicit formula for it. But we can guess what it looks like just by some general consideration of this equation with e equals 0. So for large t, we know that So the particle starts over here and then rolls over here. And by the time it gets near A, it's going to be going very slowly. For large t, x bar of t should be approximately A. And so that tells us that the x bar dt, which if e equals 0, the x bar dt is root 2v. And we can approximate v if x is near a as v of a plus a minus x v prime of a plus half a minus x squared v double prime of a. Half. And, well, by assumption, v of a is 0. So it's assumed that our minima are at 0 potential. A is a minimum of the potential or maximum of the inverted potential. So this term is also 0. So this is the dominant term. And this, by assumption, was omega squared. So that tells us that this is approximately a minus x bar omega. And that's a simple differential equation to solve. And the solution is a minus x bar is approximately e to the minus omega t. For large t, our saddle point or instanton solution will be very close to A. And the same reasoning works if we consider t to be negative and have large magnitude. Only thing that would change here is some of the signs. Then the result would be x plus a is like e to the plus omega t. So again, it's exponentially close to minus a. So we can sketch what this solution looks like based on very general properties. So solution to the saddle point equation should be, this is a, and this is minus a, should be exponentially close to a for large t, exponentially close to minus a for small t, and somewhere in the middle, it's got to cross 0. And it will do that at some time, say t1. So this is the instanton. And the name comes from the fact that all the interesting behavior just happens in a short amount of time, so an instant. And it's localized. This is a solution that's the interesting behavior is localized in time. The name comes from. And the other case, one of the four cases we'll need to consider is the case related to this one by just putting a minus sign here and a plus sign here. That will just be the same as taking t to minus t here. We're just exchanging our boundary condition, our future and past boundary conditions. So the solution will be the same with t goes to minus t. And that solution is known as the anti-instanton. The only difference is the boundary conditions. Any questions on what we've done so far? Okay, so what we've done is we found a saddle point of the path integral, and using the saddle point approximation, we can figure out how this saddle contributes to the amplitude we're trying to compute, propagator we're trying to compute. And to do that, we need the action of the instanton or anti-instanton. We'll have the same action. And for future use, I'll denote this action as S0. And by definition, it's just the integral t over 2 to minus t over 2 for Euclidean time variable of our Euclidean action and well, we haven't assumed any that much about V, so we can't compute it exactly, but we can simplify this expression a bit. So we are considering 0 energy solutions of the Euclidean equation of motion, which means there is a relationship between dx bar and v. And it'd be easier to use that if we, instead of integrating over t, integrate over dx bar. And what we have here is x bar dot is v. So here we just used our zero energy condition. And well, then using this again, right. We just change variables. Now, if we use this, we can simplify this equation, and what we get is the integral to V bar of x. So that's as far as we can go without assuming something more about V. But one important property of this equation that we can see from putting it in this form is that when x is very close to the minimum, we assumed had zero potential, then the integrand is very small. So most of the contribution, the action of the instanton, comes from this region, where the instanton moves away from the one of the minima and moves toward the other minima. So the integral over this part, where the instanton is near one of the minima, is negligible. And that will be important in a minute. Okay, so we found a saddle of our path integral. And So that tells us, well, if that was the only saddle, then saddle point approximation would tell us what this amplitude is. There are going to be other contributions, but let's just look at what the contribution to this amplitude from a single instanton is. And so, well, there's going to be e to the minus Euclidean action. There will also be, well, we found not just a single solution, but a family of solutions. So, well, can anyone tell me why that's the case?
Why what?
Why I claim we found not just a single solution to the Euclidean equations of motion, but a family. That's right. So T1 here was an unspecified parameter. The instanton could be centered at any time. And so we found here a family of solutions, not just a single solution. And this location of the center is also something called a modulus or a collective coordinate. And so if we want to incorporate that into our saddle point approximation, we need to integrate over all possible locations of the center. So this is because the location of the center is unspecified. And, well, so this is the saddle. We could also incorporate fluctuations about the saddle. And at leading order, those fluctuations will just be given by a determinant. So this, like the determinant of the Hessian, the minus a half. But, well, the fact that we've got family of solutions, all with the same action, makes this expression a little bit problematic. So there's a direction in configuration space in which we can perturb a solution with a particular center so that the center just moves an infinitesimal amount. So that's a flat direction. In configuration space, the action won't change if we just perturb the center by a little bit. So that means that the Hessian is going to have a zero eigenvalue. So we've already basically accounted for that zero eigenvalue by integrating over the centers. So we shouldn't include the zero eigenvalue in this determinant. And there can also be some normalization. We have not been careful about how we normalized the path integral. This expression is just the contribution from one instanton with any center. As I just mentioned, the one instanton solutions are not the only saddle points. So we need to both find those other saddle points and incorporate them if we want to compute this amplitude. So,
question.
Yes.
So, the Hessian matrix has a zero eigenvalue because that minimizes saddle point. Oh, sorry, that zero of the change in action is a saddle point.
Yes, so basically we've got not just an isolated minimum of the action, but there's a family that they're all degenerate. So if we move in that direction in configuration space, there's no change in the action.
I'm asking, that's a property of Hessian matrices, that they have zero eigenvalue when you're at a settle point?
Not always. That's a property of, if we have a modulus or a collective coordinate like this. So here we've got a family of saddle points that are continuously connected to each other. In that case, then we have a zero eigenvalue. It's also possible, although in quantum field theory, it's hard to find examples, but in quantum mechanics, you can find examples where there won't necessarily be a flat direction. So we certainly saw in the front end course where we're just looking at ordinary integrals, there you can have isolated saddle points. But if we have a family, all with the same action.
If there's a flat direction, then there's a flat.
Yes. Okay. Okay, so our other, so the instanton solution we found basically corresponds to a particle rolling down this valley and up this hill once, or in the Minkowski version, tunneling through the barrier once. We could also have solutions that roll from minus A to A, back to minus A and back, and any number of times, or the tunnel back and forth through the two minima of the potential any number of times. And so those solutions, which will only be approximate solutions if T is finite, but will become exact solutions if T capital T, the time interval, goes to infinity, will look something like this. So the case we've been considering, you can have a string of alternating instantons that go from minus A to A. And we have to have one more instanton than anti-instantons to satisfy our boundary conditions, where we go from minus A to A. So these become saddle points as T goes to infinity. And while we can compute using our observation that the only contributions to the Euclidean action come from the regions where our saddle point are away from the minima, the action of a solution like this is approximately n times S naught, where n is the total number of instantons and anti-instantons. And so these will be the only saddles, just either one or n instanton solutions. And so we can then use the saddle point approximation to get the amplitude we're interested in. And again, it will have some normalization need to sum over the all of our saddle points, and can have an odd number of total instantons plus anti-instantons. We need to incorporate fluctuations about each of the instantons. And then we need to integrate over all of the collective coordinates, the locations of the centers of all of the instantons. And so this integral is one we've done in Drifty 1. This just gives t to the n over n factorial. If the upper limits were all t over 2, we'd get just the volume of a hypercube. The limits by symmetry, you can argue you get a factor 1 over n factorial. And so what we get is then just a geometric series, or the difference between two geometric series, two exponential series. So we get e to kt, e to the minus s naught over h bar, if we just do the sum, minus the minus kt the minus s naught over h bar. And I'll denote this as a minus b. And this is the same as we get if we considered, if we reverse the boundary conditions by symmetry. And so what would change if we consider the other two cases? In the other two cases, if initial and final boundary conditions are the same, symmetry will give us the same thing. Basically, the only thing that would change is we need to have an even number of instantons and anti-instantons. We would want to end up where we started. So the only difference between computation we did and these other two cases is instead of summing over n odd, we need to sum over n even. And the same result, instead of the difference between these two terms, we'll get the sum of them. And so now we've computed all these amplitudes. These are not, A and minus A are not energy eigenstates. The energy eigenstates are the linear combinations, symmetric and antisymmetric. And by diagonalizing the transition amplitudes we just found, you can show that the lowest energy levels are 1/2 h bar omega, plus or minus h bar k, e to the minus s naught over h bar, where this term will come from setting C equal to omega or pi the h bar half e to the minus omega t over 2. This prefactor is not so important. This part will give us this term once we take the log. And you can show that if you want to define the normalization of these path integrals in a way that's independent of the potential, then this has to be the time dependence. And the argument for that is one way to do it is using the Gelfand-Jagiellon theorem that was an optional problem in QFT2. I won't go into that, but that's where this part comes from. This part basically just comes from taking the log or expression here, dividing, multiplying by h bar divided by t. And so we see that the energy difference, as promised, is dominated by these non-perturbative instanton effects. You might be skeptical of these formulas because, well, this term is exponentially small. In principle, there could be perturbative corrections to this formula that are much larger than that. But the by symmetry, those perturbative corrections will correct the energies of both of these states in the same way. And so the dominant contribution to the difference will be this term. So I'll wrap up here. Tomorrow we'll go through the other two cases, which the periodic potential and the unstable potential. And we'll be able to borrow much of our analysis. Only a few steps will change. I'll postpone that till tomorrow. So the periodic potential will be very interesting because it's going to have close relations to the theta vacua, the vacuum states of gauge theories in quantum field theory. And the unstable potential in quantum mechanics will have applications to the decay of the false vacuum in QFT. So we'll start to see some of those QFT applications of these ideas tomorrow. And we'll also discuss what it means to add perturbative and non-perturbative contributions.